abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Tuesday, December 10th, 2013. We are talking foreign policy today, and in particular, what I want to do today is talk to an expert on the subject of Afghanistan, because I think there are a lot of us who are against the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. We'd like to get the troops out of Afghanistan, but really don't know a lot of details about it. You know, really don't know the ins and outs of who's who and what's going on and how did it get started and all that. And so I wanted to bring on Eric Margolese because he has traveled more widely than anybody I know and who also has the mind of a journalist and a historian. And I thought he'd really be the ideal person to sort of do a, you know, kind of an Afghanistan 101 for us here. But before we do that, a couple quick notes. I've got a lot of feedback regarding my podcast on Pope Francis from last week, and most of it was favorable, but I am really surprised at how many people responded by saying Woods is being so unfair to the Pope. I mean, he's just accepting what the media says about the Pope's message, and that's not what the Pope means at all. He's not talking about capitalism. The word capitalism doesn't even appear in the document. I got this more than once. The word capitalism doesn't appear in the document. Okay, but the word markets is there, I don't know, two dozen times? Like, so what is the point of telling me that capitalism isn't in there? If anything, condemning markets is even worse. So that does not help that person's argument at all. There is a phenomenon in the Catholic world that I have seen for years of wishful thinking. When a pope says something, and this really only happens in the post-Vatican II period, when a pope says something that's totally scandalous, some people just can't wrap their heads around it because they have an exaggerated view of papal authority, so they feel like, well, I have to believe everything the pope says. So when something scandalous is said, it's, he didn't say it. He didn't say it. It's a misinterpretation. It's the evil media. Stupid media. Media hates the pope. Always trying to misinterpret him. Now, look, that's not impossible. The media does twist people's words. Of course, that's true. But I've found in case after case that I look and I say, well, yeah, it does look like the Pope was calling for this. Or, yeah, there is this crazy statement. Yeah, I see it. I don't think you're helping by making non-Catholics think, wow, apparently you're not even allowed to acknowledge reality? Wow, that sounds like a great thing I want to join. I think you have to be blunt and straightforward with people. So, no, it's, and then I had people saying, no, he's talking about markets today, you know, which are hemmed in on all sides, right? He's talking about the way markets are manipulated and by the Fed, and he's talking about interventionist sort of markets that we have today. He's not talking about pure markets. Oh, yeah, where does he make that distinction? Give me the paragraph number where that distinction is made. That's nowhere in there. And that's a pretty important clarification, right? You'd think it would be acknowledged somewhere that, yes, of course I'm not talking about markets in the abstract, which is a great idea, but in practice, governments have screwed them up and central banks aren't even mentioned. What an unbelievable and inexcusable oversight. Central banks are not even mentioned? So no, I do not accept these criticisms at all. This is wishful thinking of a sort that has just got to come to an end. You've got to face reality here. And it's okay to face reality. Just acknowledge the limited nature of papal authority, which we ought to do. We got to get out of this cult of personality around the popes that would have astonished almost every pope who ever lived. So anyway, that's my stuff on Pope Francis. You can read my book, The Church and the Market. You'll really like it. It's a really consistent Austrian treatise that deals with some of these papal statements and tries to make sense out of it from a Catholic point of view, but in a way that I think anybody can appreciate, because there's a lot of stuff in there that somebody wanting to learn about the Austrian school would, I think, want to read. Okay, just one quick thing before we get to Eric Margolis. Of course, you know that my LibertyClassroom.com had a big deal going on at Black Friday, 35% off gift subscriptions for your loved ones, or even, I don't know, even for your enemies. That's okay. Doesn't matter to me, whoever it is. But anyway, I had this special offer. LibertyClassroom.com is my year-and-a-half-old site. Gosh, we're coming up on 2 years soon, where we now have 9 courses in history, in economics, in logic, and in political philosophy, teaching you stuff that you probably didn't learn in school. I sure as heck didn't learn in school. And they're courses you can learn on the go. You don't have to make time to sit in front of your computer, for heaven's sake. You learn it on the go. Plus, Q&A forums for any questions you have, we will answer them. So 35% off is still going for you listeners in a secret deal at libertyclassroom.com/secret. Only you listeners know about this. I have not Facebooked this. I haven't Twittered it or tweeted it, tweeted it. I haven't blogged it. Only you guys know about libertyclassroom.com/secret. This is a secret deal for you guys. All right, I had Eric Margolis come on. I recorded a program with him, and this was a day when I was having spotty internet. I have not ever had spotty internet in this office. And then, by the way, I had it recently. I was hosting the Peter Schiff Show. Monday, I had it, and I realized that all I had to do was reset the router. Problem solved. It's not unstable anymore. It's fine. Well, anyway, most of these guests I've had on so far are people I know personally. I've just traveled a lot in libertarian circles. I've had the good fortune of getting to know a lot of these people. I didn't know Eric Margolis personally, but I invited him on. He was very gracious. So the one guy I don't know personally gets booted off our Skype call. I had to do this one on Skype, unfortunately. And he gets booted off our Skype call because of my stupid internet. So I had to, I finally got the internet back up and running. And so he only had like 6 or 8 minutes left to spare me. And so in what follows is a recording. When we get bumped off, I will intervene and say, all right, everybody, this is where we had the internet disaster. Now here's where we resume. I'm sorry about this. This will never happen again. But who is Eric Margolis? Well, this guy is about as accomplished as you could possibly ask for. He's an award-winning, internationally syndicated columnist for 27 years. He was a contributing editor to the Toronto Sun chain of newspapers. He wrote mainly about the Middle East, South Asia, and Islam. His articles have appeared in every publication under the sun all over the world, major newspapers. He appears as an expert on foreign affairs on all the major cable news channels. He was among the first journalists ever to interview Libya's Muammar Gaddafi. He was among the first to be allowed access to KGB headquarters in Moscow. As a war correspondent, he's covered conflicts in Angola, Namibia, South Africa, Mozambique, Sinai, Afghanistan, Kashmir, India, Pakistan, El Salvador, and Nicaragua. The guy has been everywhere. His books include War at the Top of the World, The Struggle for Afghanistan, Kashmir, and Tibet, and also American Raj, The West and the Muslim World. That book talks about why there's so much anger against the West in the Muslim world. It talks about Al-Qaeda, etc. So check him out at ericmargolis.com, Eric, MARGOLIS.com. And so now I'm going to play for you my interview with Eric Margolis, which has a little problem, and I'm sorry about that, but he's awesome, and here we go. Eric Margolis, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Nice to be with you.
Now, the reason I invited you on, even though I know you talk an awful lot about current events, is that I'd like you to paint a broad picture for my listeners of the situation in Afghanistan since 9/11. Because I think I have a lot of anti-war listeners who want the troops out, but I bet with a lot of us, if you wanted the details of what's really going on, or if you were faced with a neocon who said, no, surrender is unthinkable, we have to keep the troops there forever, it might be hard to to answer that. So I wonder if I can ask you some basic broad questions about the situation and then lead up to where we are today. So let's imagine we're on the eve of 9/11. Can you describe for us what Afghanistan looks like? You've got the Taliban and you've got the Northern Alliance. What is the origin of the Northern Alliance?
The Northern Alliance is an ethnic Tajik group from the north of Afghanistan. The Tajiks are the traditional blood enemies of the majority Pashtuns. The Tajiks are more cultivated, more cultured. They speak Dari, a Persian language. The Pashtuns are mountaineers. They're very tough, and they speak Pashto. But they're all Muslims, Sunni Muslims largely. But the Tajiks traditionally look north and to Iran, whereas the Pashtun look south to their fellow Pashtun in Pakistan. The Northern Alliance was formed by northern tribal chiefs who were fighting pre-Taliban. It was cobbled together by the Soviet GRU military intelligence. And when the Soviets had invaded Afghanistan in 1989, they spent their entire time, they claimed to be Mujahideen fighting the Soviets, but in fact, they spent most of their time, as I saw personally, fighting the U.S.-backed Pashtun Mujahideen. They were infiltrated from top to bottom by Soviet agents of influence, and they were the primary movers and shakers in the opium business in Afghanistan. That's the Northern Alliance.
So does the Northern Alliance, does the United States come into contact, substantial contact with the Northern Alliance only in 2001?
It had some light contacts before that, particularly with the Northern Alliance leader, Ahmed Shah Massoud, who was ballyhooed by the Western media, was linked with French intelligence, but has now been revealed, as we knew at the time back in the 80s, that he was a longtime agent of influence for the KGB, Soviet KGB and the GRU. But the U.S. really didn't have much to do with him because it was behind the Pashtun in the south until, as you say, after 9/11, U.S. invaded and it came in immediately to enlist the help of the Northern Alliance, who had been fighting Taliban, which was then in power, which the Taliban was really just an extension of the U.S.-backed Mujahideen of the 80s. And the U.S. used the Northern Alliance troops. In fact, when the Northern Alliance entered Kabul finally with American air cover, American B-52s flying ahead, and led by at least a division, a 12,000-man division of troops from Soviet-ruled or former Soviet-ruled Uzbekistan in Afghan army uniforms, led by a Soviet general. So it was very much the nucleus of the Communist Party of Afghanistan. The Americans didn't know about this, or else we just didn't care. We just wanted to get at Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
So the United States indicates that Osama bin Laden is responsible for the atrocities on 9/11, and it approaches the Taliban and says, "We demand you turn him over." And their response was, "Well, according to our custom, he's a guest here. And so unless you supply us with the proof of his guilt, we're not going to turn him over." Was this disingenuous on their part?
No, it wasn't. Not at all. Bin Laden was a hero of the war against the Soviets. He gave great engineering help to the Mujahideen. He was regarded as a man of honor. And Taliban leaders had nothing to do with 9/11. They had no idea about it. We're not even sure to this day if bin Laden was behind it. The plot was not hatched in Afghanistan. It was hatched in Germany and in Spain. Very few people know this. So there were no visible links to Afghanistan, except there were some Al-Qaeda fighters there, a couple of hundred, but they were not there to plot against the West. They were helping Taliban to fight the communists of the Northern Alliance because bin Laden was violently anti-communist. This is how it developed. So yes, you're quite right. The Afghans spoke both as Afghan tribals and said, we can't hand over a guest without proof. But they also asked Washington for a legitimate, formal, normal extradition request detailing bin Laden's alleged crimes. Washington said they would do it, and then they completely ignored it and invaded Afghanistan. I mean, Americans wanted revenge, never mind paperwork. And later, Secretary of State Colin Powell promised that his State Department would issue a formal white paper cataloging how al-Qaeda, bin Laden, et cetera, was responsible for 9/11. This document was never published.
Well, then what was the nature of the so-called terrorist training camps that we were told the U.S. military was engaged in bombing?
Oh, very interesting. I was there. I saw them. They were not terrorists. Well, if you're an Indian, they were terrorist training camps. The majority of them were camps that were run by Pakistani intelligence, ISI, and they were training fighters to go into the Indian-ruled portion of Kashmir. And the U.S. knew all about it. But these were our allies, the Pakistanis, who were doing it. There were some other training camps for Uzbeks who bin Laden was working with in the hope of overthrowing the vile communist brutal dictatorship in Uzbekistan, which is still in power today, by the way. And then there were some other group of training camps for people from Central Asia and primarily Uyghurs. These are Turkish, ethnic Turkish tribesmen from Chinese-ruled Xinjiang, and the CIA was training them there as a possible eventuality. If we ever had war with China, the CIA would release these Uyghurs who were trained in Afghanistan, send them into China, Chinese Western China, to cause disruption, give the Chinese a hard time. There were no training camps, to my knowledge, of people being trained to attack Western targets or doing anything. This was all local stuff.
You know, we have in the U.S. a neoconservative commentator named Jonah Goldberg, and roughly 10 years ago, he said, once in a while, the U.S. has to pick up some crummy little third world country and throw it against a wall just to show we mean business. And he had Iraq in mind there. But I wonder if that might also be applicable to Afghanistan, because if you're saying that the link to Afghanistan was tenuous to non-existent, what else, apart from stories about pipelines and so on, could account for the desire just to invade somewhere, anywhere, and why would they choose Afghanistan in particular?
Well, I don't quite subscribe to that view. I mean, there's the old saying that an army has to be bloodied every once in a while to keep it efficient. As this Goldberg character is a typical chicken hawk neocon, never saw military service in his life, probably. I doubt that he did. But is ferocious and bloodthirsty from the safety of his parents' home. But that's nonsense. The U.S. military couldn't have picked a more logistically difficult country to wage war in than in Afghanistan. But there was an interest in Afghanistan that long predated 9/11, was, as you mentioned, pipelines, oil, and the fact that Afghanistan looks down on the whole Caspian energy basin, which had just been revealed at that point, or was coming up and producing oil and gas. It prevents the Chinese from moving into that empty square on the chessboard. It's very strategic territory. So the U.S. had been thinking about it. 9/11 offered the pretext to go into Afghanistan and a way of venting American shock and horror and dismay over the 9/11 attacks.
Now, a lot of times we hear the objection that if the U.S. withdraws, well, without full victory, whatever that would look like, then Afghanistan will once again become a haven for terrorism. But I guess part of your reply would involve this argument that you're making here, which is that it wasn't one from the U.S. point of view anyway in the first place.
That's quite right. And now there were some al-Qaeda there. I'm one of the few people who says that al-Qaeda was not necessarily what Washington is describing. They were not anti-Western terrorists. In fact, I knew very well the founder of al-Qaeda, Sheikh Azam, who was the teacher of bin Laden. And their whole raison d'etre was anti-communist and liberating oppressed Muslim nations from despots, the biggest one being Saudi Arabia. So they weren't pro-Western, but their chief impetus was not to attack the West, just for the sake of it. Well, this argument that, oh, if we don't stay there, the place will be turned into a nest of terrorists again, it's nonsense. Secretary Panetta said some time back that there were between 25 and 50 al-Qaeda members in Afghanistan. That's all. And the U.S., believe me, I just flew over Afghanistan last week. The U.S. doesn't control 80% of it. So there's ample room right now in this wild, mountainous country for anybody who wants to do things there. What's more important is now we see suddenly the dragon's teeth coming up, al-Qaeda in Yemen. Well, Yemen's another wild and woolly place where the government's writ doesn't extend far. And it's a paradise for so-called terrorists. So's Somalia, so's Libya now.
Okay, everybody, here's where I lost him. Doh! All right, but now we get him back right here. Now, anytime there's a U.S. intervention, you will get a faction of U.S. progressives who will say things like, well, at least we're bringing feminism to the country in question. We're bringing progressive Western values over there. How has that actually worked out in practice? What's the difference in people's lives now as compared to how it was on September 10th, 2001?
Well, it's ironic because when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, they used as one of their primary reasons they were coming to liberate women and they were coming to bring education. And one of the reasons we see so much anti-education feeling amongst the Pashtun and the Taliban is that the Afghan and Soviet communists use the educational system to infiltrate Afghan society and try and promote communism through the schools and universities. The West has brought some benefits to women in Kabul, but not anywhere else in Afghanistan, which remains a very primitive, medieval-type country. And whether it's the Pashtun or whether it's the Northern Alliance people in the north, they're all beating their women, and the women are veiled, and it's deeply ingrained cultural things. This baloney of selling the war in Afghanistan to the public because we're trying to liberate women is simply not true. The French use the same argument too. It resonates, but it is in fact not the case. What we have brought to Afghanistan is massive corruption at all levels, hundreds of billions of dollars of bribes. Everyone is bribed in Afghanistan. We've increased tribal and ethnic hatred in Afghanistan. And on top of that, we've seen the drug trade in Afghanistan grow, according to the UN, by 50% alone last year. We own Afghanistan. We Americans own Afghanistan. And yet it has now become, it's producing 90% of the world's opium and then heroin.
What is Obama's most recent policy statement with regard to the future of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan?
The official statement is that all U.S. combat troops will be withdrawn by 2014.
You believe that?
Just read the fine print. I just wrote a column about this. Read the fine print. 14 to 16,000 troops will remain in U.S. bases. They are not combat troops. Oh, no, no, no. They are training troops and anti-terrorism troops, but it's just a label change. There will be 12 to 15,000 CIA mercenaries The U.S. Air Force will patrol the skies. The drones will stay there. And there's the Afghan puppet army, which is about 300,000 men, who we pay to pretend to support the government. So the bulk of American troops will go out, but we will still have an imperial presence there based in forts and air bases that I just said is identical to the way the British ruled Iraq in the 1920s.
All right, Eric, I'm going to put you on the spot for our last question, which is, it's September 11th, 2001, and you're the President of the United States. What do you do?
Oh, I listen to advisors who know anything about the area of Afghanistan, and I go to the Taliban, and I said, okay, we'll just arrest bin Laden and any of the senior al-Qaeda leaders, which they would have, and send them for trial in a Muslim country. They said they would. Send them to trial in Turkey, for example. Show the evidence, and we'll pay you, bakshish, to go and hunt them down if we want to kill them all. You can have bombs or bakshish, but you have to do it courteously and diplomatically. Where the people in Washington didn't know enough, didn't know never to tell a Pashtun, you have to do this or else. They'll come and cut your throat if you do that. They needed some diplomacy and some intelligence. Instead, we had a very stupid and ultimately totally ruinous policy in Afghanistan, and still have.
Of course, you could imagine the U.S. president's response if any other country had demanded the U.S. do such and such. Right? Never!
Take the case of Italy, which has just indicted 11 U.S. CIA agents for kidnapping. We wouldn't turn them over. Told the Italians to go to hell. So that's quite right. But we blundered into this, and that is because we have such ruinous policy in that part of the world, because we never listen to the right people. We listen to these little armchair neocons rather than the old area hands who've seen it and done it, know what's going on.
Well, Eric Margulies, I certainly appreciate your time and this briefing for us. And of course, if only they'd listened to you, which is, I know you didn't say that, but I'm certainly thinking it, we'd be in a lot better shape than we are now. Thanks so much for being on here today.
My pleasure.
All right, that's going to do it for the show for today. Make sure and check out ericmargulies.com. And also, please, when you're doing your shopping in December on Amazon, make sure and enter Amazon through our widget at tomwoodsradio.com, because then at no cost to you, you help us keep the lights on and pay the bills here in our little Tom Woods Show office. If you can't see the Amazon widget, that's because you've got an ad blocker running. So the ad blocker has to be so you can see it. But most of you guys are able to see it. You are helping us out, and it really warms my heart. This week, lots of great programming coming up, so don't you miss it. Make sure and subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher, and I'll see you guys tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.